This project is co-financed by the European Commission under the European Integration Fund and is supported by the Office for the Promotion of Migrant Integration in the Department of Justice and Equality and PABO.
Good evening and welcome to this week's edition of Culture Shots. This week, leading on from a previous episode, we'll be looking at songs and stories from our home countries. That's myself, Gillian McInerney from Ireland, Irene Alvarez, who's from Venezuela, and Evan Shirahuru, who's going to be up first telling his story.
Thomas Mapfumo is a legend in Zimbabwean music. He started singing in the 60s and was prominent in the struggle for Zimbabwe's independence. He blends his music with Zimbabwean traditional music, which includes mbira, jazz, and jiti. At the present moment, he's living in exile because he's a critic of the present government. In this track, which is titled Andradze, which in Shona means brother or sister, he's singing about a lazy uncle, which in Zimbabwe means a mother's brother.
And that was Evan Shirahuru telling us the story of Andradze. My name's Gillian McInerney, and I'm going to tell you an Irish legend about a very famous man called Fionn McCool. So the story goes that Fionn's mother, Muirne, gave birth to him after Fionn's father had been killed in battle. And Muirne felt she couldn't protect the young Fionn, so she gave him to a female druid called Bowel and a woman warrior named Leia to raise and teach him the ways of the warrior and the magical arts. So when Fionn was old enough, he went to learn poetry from Phineas, who was the master. Phineas, who was a great, great poet, lived on the banks of the River Boyne. Phineas was also the guardian of a magical salmon, and legend states that whoever ate this salmon would possess all knowledge and foresight. Phineas guarded this salmon for 7 years before himself deciding to cook it and eat it. Fionn, who was helping to roast the salmon, was there when juice spurted out and burned him on the thumb. Automatically, Fionn sucked the burning juice from his thumb and accidentally gained all of the knowledge. From that day on, any time Fionn sucked his thumb, he had all of the knowledge and foresight for forthcoming events. This is known as the Salmon of Knowledge in Irish folklore. Fionn became the leader of the Fianna, who were ancient warriors and protectors of Ireland. They consisted of 50 chiefs, who each had 27 men serving under them. The Fianna were not only made up of warriors, but had druids, physicians and musicians in their ranks. To join the Fianna, each warrior had to endure a rigorous initiation, which included tasks like learning to recite a poet's entire repertoire by heart. They also had to pass various tests of courage and strength, for example, being bombarded with spears and being able to remove a thorn from the sole of their foot while running and stooping under low branches. Only then were they deemed worthy to join the mighty Fianna. One day, whilst out hunting with the Fianna, Fionn encountered Saive, a beautiful woman who, by refusing the advances of Fardorka, was transformed into a deer. Whilst in the vicinity of the Fianna, however, Fardorka had no magical hold over, and she remained in her human form. Fionn fell madly in love and married Saive, but one day she left the protection of her home and once again became a deer. 7 years later, Fionn's hounds, Bran and Scullin, found a little boy. It was Fionn and Saive's son, Oisin. Years later, the daughter of Cormac MacArt, Gráinne, was promised in marriage to Fionn, but when she saw his greying hair, she wondered if it was more appropriate to marry Oisin. But at the wedding party, however, she saw Diarmaid, Fionn's nephew, and a great hero in the Fianna, and decided that it was him she wanted to be with. Gráinne gave all the guests at the wedding feast a sleeping draught, and while Fionn and their guests slumbered, Gráinne and Diarmaid ran away together. Fionn was furious at this betrayal by them, and swore that the two lovers would never sleep under the same roof for two consecutive nights, or eat a meal in the same place twice. All across Ireland today, there remains numerous stone circles and cairns which bear the inscription, "The Bed of Diarmaid and Gráinne." It's believed such places as Port Lebrón, Dolmen, a single chamber megalithic tomb, was built by Gráinne and Diarmaid, who were on the run. After a long pursuit, Fionn finally made peace with the couple and sent Diarmaid to kill a boar which wounded him. Diarmaid begged for a healing potion from Fionn, but Fionn's true feelings of jealousy showed themselves and he allowed the potion to drip from his fingers to the ground, leaving Diarmaid to die. Fionn McCool is reported to have stood at a whopping 52.5 feet tall and is credited with shaping some of Ireland's most stunning coastline. An area made up of basalt hexagonal columns, aptly named the Giant's Causeway, is one of the most breathtaking sights to see and has been called one of the modern wonders of the world. Story goes that Fionn invited the Scottish giant, Benadonner, to visit Ireland for a contest of strength. Fionn, deciding as an act of hospitality to build a walkway between Scotland and Ireland so that Benadonner would not get his feet wet while he crossed the Irish Sea, started to lay down hexagonal stones. After a few weeks of intensive work, the pathway was nearing completion, and Benadonner's home, Fingal Cave, was only a stride away. Fionn, exhausted, lay down to sleep. At dawnbreak next morning, Fionn's wife Una woke to find the thundering footsteps of Benadonner striding towards their home. Quickly realizing the still resting Fionn would be no match for Benadonner, she woke Fionn and dressed him in one of her nightgowns, placing a bonnet on his head, and urged him to pretend to sleep. Walking into the cave, Benadonner roared, "Right, where's he hiding?" Pointing to the sleeping form of Fionn, Una replied, "Be quiet or you'll wake our baby." Thinking Fionn was indeed their child, Benadonner made a hasty retreat as he did not want to wait around to meet the father. He was last seen running back across the causeway, tearing it up in his wake, leaving visitor after visitor to marvel at the spectacular coastline that is Fionn's legacy to Ireland. Another legend tells how Fionn created the largest freshwater lakes in the British Isles, Loch Ness. Situated in the north of Ireland, its banks touch 5 of the 6 counties, and it's ranked among the 40 of the largest lakes in Europe. Story goes, once again, that our intrepid warrior was engaged in battle with another giant, and he reached down, scooped up a piece of land in his massive hand to throw at his rival across the water. Falling short of his intended target, the land crashed into the Irish Sea and formed what is now known as the Isle of Man. Fionn not only outlived his son and grandson, he survived to unfortunately see the massacre of his beloved Fianna at the Battle of the Gavra. In fact, there is no known record of Fionn's death. It is widely believed that he is not dead, but he has just faded away into the other world, where he sleeps peacefully to rise again when Ireland needs him. My second story is about Oisin, who's Fionn's son. Long ago in Ireland, there lived a man called Oisin. He was the handsome son of Fionn and was the poet of the Fianna. Oisin had silky red hair and sky blue eyes. He was tall and strong. Fionn was proud of Oisin because he could tell the history of the Fianna with exciting stories and poems. One summer's day, Fionn, Oisin and the Fianna were cooking fish on a beach and singing songs. Then the singing stopped in the middle of a word. They saw a lady riding a white horse over the water. As the horse splashed towards the shore, Oisin saw that the rider was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen. The blue-eyed lady rode towards Fionn. Her blonde hair flowed around her face. Her cloak sparkled like jewels in the sun. "I am Niamh," she explained. "I have come to Ireland from Tír na n Óg, the land of the young. I once saw Oisin while he was out hunting. I have fallen in love with him." Turning to Oisin, she continued, "Tír na n Óg is a land where the sun always shines. No one is ever sick or old. Everyone eats his favourite foods and plays games. There are storytellers and music. The houses are made of gold and jewels. Birds sing. Colourful flowers grow. People wear soft, glittering clothes. Oisin, please come to Tír na n Óg with me." By this time, Oisin had fallen in love with Niamh too. He turned and hugged Fionn and said goodbye to his Fianna friends. He jumped onto the horse and off they rode over the water. Niamh and Oisin travelled for hours over the waves. The horse galloped over the water as if it was dry land. When they reached Tír na n Óg, Oisin could hardly believe his eyes. The houses looked like castles shining in the light. The trees were full of ripe fruit. In the air there were sounds of singing and smells of roasting meat and fresh bread. On Oisin's skin the breeze felt soft and warm. Oisin was happy for many years, but one day about 10 years later Oisin began to miss Ireland. He missed his father, Fionn, and the Fianna. He asked to borrow the magic horse to visit Ireland once more. Niamh agreed, but she told Oisin that many things had changed in Ireland. She also warned him that if his feet touched the ground, he could never return to Tír na n Óg. Oisin rode to Ireland as fast as he could. When he arrived, he scratched his head in puzzlement. The men of Ireland seemed much smaller and weaker than those he had known before. Worse yet, Fionn and the Fianna were no longer alive. Few people had heard of the Fianna, but they thought it was just an old myth. Oisin cried. He had discovered that what seemed like 10 years in Tír na n Óg had really been 300 years in Ireland. As he rode along, thinking sad thoughts, he saw 15 men trying to move a rock. They pushed and they pulled. They could not move it. Oisin reached down and easily lifted the rock, but as he did, he lost his balance and fell off the magic horse. The horse ran off to the sea. The 15 men watched in fear. Oisin, a young, strong man, was changing into a very, very old man. His hair turned white. He stooped with age. He spoke in a creaky voice as he told the men about his stay in Tír na n Óg. He told of his friends, the Fianna. Oisin died of old age in front of the men. The men buried him in the soil of Ireland, the land he loved. Up next is Irina Alvarez with a famous song from Venezuela.
Simon Diaz is perhaps the most important musician in Venezuela. For more than 50 years, Uncle Simon, as he is called by all Venezuelans, has dedicated to recover the folklore and musical traditions of the Venezuelan plains. His music has reached unexpected places all over the world. It has been sung by various international artists such as the Gypsy Kings, Ray Conniff, and Julio Iglesias. His works have been adapted by symphonies and choral ensembles throughout Venezuela. And on September 2008, he was awarded by the Latin Grammy with a Lifetime Achievement Award. In the Venezuelan plains, the rainy season, which lasts 6 months, is used to milk the cows. Cows are enclosed and separated from their calves the night before. At dawn, one by one are released together with their calf. And to be able to do this, each has to be named. Then the milker sings a tonada, a beautiful folk music genre, where he mentions the cow's name who is going to be milked next. The cow and the calf are called the same, and when they hear their name, they know it's their turn to get to the doors. The calf's keeper's work is to release only the animal that has been called. The female is tied, and when her baby gets close, the milk starts to go down. Always singing, the milker works quickly, and with his song, he describes the landscape, the plains life. He tells his stories, and he heals his sorrows. Behind poetry, truth relies. That is why a tonada can be understood by anyone, even if they know nothing about the field. Simon Díaz was a calf's keeper as a child. That is why he collected many of these songs, and he wrote many more. I saw a great blue heron fighting against the river. This is how it falls in love, your heart with mine. Full moon, go home, boy, and bring me the rifle to kill that hog that is leaving me with no chicken. These are part of the lyrics of Tonada de Luna Llena, or the Full Moon Tune by Simon Díaz. And this was the story of the song you will hear now.
This is Evans Shirihuru, and today I'm talking to Jerry Cooley. Welcome to the program, Jerry.
Yeah, very. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Jerry, the reason why I called you, I think you know that we want to talk about your book.
Yeah.
And also as a tour guide.
Yeah.
You probably will be one of the people who've got an insight on how Ireland is changing.
Yes.
Also, as somebody who grew up in Dublin as well,
yeah,
you have some perspective on that topic. First of all, let me just say to you, what I liked about your book was that it has some clear illustrations and some photos which makes it easier, or which makes it compelling for people to relate to you, because you are clear. Unlike some other books or biographies, it's just
text.
Some words, text, but there isn't, you don't see the face of the person who will be writing about the whatever that happened to your life. That's why I'm sort of interested in it. But before we go any further, what is the title of your book and why did you choose it?
The title of the book is called Turn at the Pine Trees, and it's a play on the name of the place is Turnapin, which comes from the old Irish Tornabin, which means the well on the hill. So that was the tradition here. Irish places would have Irish language names, and when the English were mapping in the mid-1800s, they would have gotten the Irish name, and they were the nearest phonetic sounding word.
Okay.
They would name it.
Okay.
And that's where it came from.
That's
so turn a pin, and then at the moment, for the last 100 years, at the top of the street that I'm talking about, there are pine trees, and they're still there.
Okay.
So when you turn at the pine trees off the main road, you're in Turnapin. So it was a play on the name Turnapin.
What is the significance of Turnapin Lane?
Well, Turnapin was where I grew up. It was built in the 1930s, and 36 cottages. It's still there to this day. And I grew up there, and my parents were both born there. And and they grew up there. So I would have had a similar childhood to my own parents in growing up in Turnipin Lane.
Okay. And in your book, you did mention one guy, a guy called PJ Jones.
Yes.
I would come to you that when I saw a chapter about him, it sort of came back to me because there was a similar guy where I grew up in Zimbabwe. Why did you choose to write about this guy, significance about him in your life?
Well, he was part of my formative years. He was part of my brothers would have worked for him. People down the road would have worked for him. My neighbours worked for him. It was a little bit of a rite of passage. I suppose it was typical. It was your first venture to actually do something and get paid money for it. And he is the man in our area. And I'm delighted to hear that you have a similar guy. And that's exactly the type of thing I love to hear, because I believe that local is global and global is local.
Definitely, yeah. And what made you to decide to write a book?
Well, there's a good question. I always wanted to tell the story. I'm a good storyteller. It comes natural to me. And I always thought that this little area, it told a national story. It told the move from rural to urban.
Okay.
Rural settings being overwhelmed by rural. The people were interested in it. I loved the place, and I decided that I'd do it for posterity so people could relate to it and read it and enjoy it on one level as a funny stories, and the narrative is interesting. But as well as that, it's a social historical document. I'm a historian. I want to know what happened. I believe that there's lessons to be learned in what we did in the past, how we overcame things, because these stories are they're a little bit of nourishment and encouragement to people that look, things are bad, but they're not really that bad.
There's
an innate humour in the Irish and a hard work ethic in the Irish and an openness in the Irish that will see us through in the end.
Yeah, I'm delighted that the main reason why probably I chose to speak to you on our program Culture Shots is because we talked about migrants, we talked about gays and lesbians, we talked about almost every other culture, but we have not yet time to actually speak about the Irish culture.
The Irish culture. Well, you couldn't have chosen a better subject, because exactly, I'm really, really proud to be Irish. And as a tour guide, it's my job to bring people here and tell them our story, past and present, present to these people an experience in Ireland that they've paid good money to come and participate in. But as well as that, don't sell out, show them who we are, what we're about, and tell the Irish story.
On that subject, as a tour guide, can you explain to me what changes you have seen in Ireland, particularly in Dublin, the area which you worked, what do you think it does mean to an Irish native?
Well, first of all, Dublin is a port. So we were used to people. Like the sailors and people have been coming in here for centuries.
Okay.
People in Dublin are descended from them.
Okay.
Spanish, Portuguese, African. They've been coming in here for hundreds of years.
Okay.
But we wouldn't have seen any organised immigration coming into this country in the 60s and 70s. It was only really, as I was explaining to you earlier on, the first people from Africa that I seen were doctors.
Okay.
In the children's hospital. 60s, 70s, people from Libya would have been, particularly I remember them be training as pilots.
Okay.
Chinese people coming in, starting restaurants. But this was all in the 80s. It started to take off in the 80s, but in the 90s there was a bit of a boom.
Okay.
It just boomed. And I think Ireland was just a little bit overwhelmed. We were sort of caught napping. We ended up sleepwalking through it and sort of saying, where are all these people coming from? Why are they here? What do we need to do to... they're coming over here to work, but to move beyond work, setting up home, having children, going to schools, how people with different languages were catering for it.
Okay.
I think generally we were overwhelmed a little bit. And when you're overwhelmed, you sort of maybe shy away from it and say, look, I'm not interested. I don't want to know. You know, I'm getting on with what I want to do. I don't want to know.
Okay, so as a tour guide, are you in a position to able to explain probably to some an Irish man or woman who might not have direct contact with these people?
Yeah, well, I have it both ways. I have people coming in from Japan, China, from Israel, from Romania, coming in as tourists.
Okay.
And I'm explaining to them what's going on around them. I suppose the first thing that you notice is, say, old traditional shops being changed to other uses, more flamboyant and colourful. That's the colour added aspect to it. Particularly from the African community, it seems to be just more, it's more colourful.
More colourful.
Yeah, it's more colourful. The landscape changes a little bit. There's one street we're going to talk about, Moore Street, I suppose.
Yeah, I was going to question to you. I was going to ask you about Moore Street.
Yeah.
What is the historical perspective of Moore Street? And also, can you explain what is its significance to Dublin or Ireland at large?
Okay, well, Moore Street is named after Henry Moore. You've got Henry Street, you've got Moore Street, and he was the Earl of Drogheda. So there's Earl Street and there's Drogheda Street. So he was an English gentry.
Okay,
and the place was named after him.
Okay,
he was a bit of he wanted his name.
All right.
A megalomaniac. It grew up a tradition of having stalled markets, stall. Where you sell fruit, where you sell vegetables, where people, working class people, and you've got to remember, this was before supermarkets came.
Okay.
So people in the 50s, you could not, before supermarkets came to Ireland, you had to buy your groceries in a pub. The pub and the grocery shop were together.
Okay.
So when the supermarkets came, they opened all of that. But prior to that, there was this little stall area for Moore Street.
Okay.
And Dubliners always associated these street hawkers, these Dublin women. They're from the streets. They can be vocal.
Okay.
And they don't suffer fools gladly.
Okay.
And are streetwise, and Dubliners love them because they're a part of old Dublin.
Okay.
Before the supermarkets came.
All right.
So Moore Street is was a great tradition of butcher shops. At one stage, there was 35 butcher shops in Moore Street.
Okay.
35 of them. 35. There's three now, I think.
Okay.
Three. Okay. The Moore Street it was for hawkers, and then in 1916, when the revolution finished. And we were going to surrender. The leaders decided to surrender. They went to a shop in Moore Street. They took it over and they decided they were going to surrender there. So it has a historical significance on the right-hand side. And that's when we go down that right-hand side, Dubliners feel a little bit disappointed that the Dublin City Fathers haven't taken that by the scruff of the neck, that side of the street, and organised
it.
Wanted to be preserved. No, not as a museum. Convert it into old Dublin style shops. And by all means, it's great to see the colour of the guys with the phones, the ladies selling the hair extensions and the nails, all of that stuff. By all means, have it there.
Yeah.
Because there's like they're business people, they're working, they're doing something.
Yeah.
But people from Dublin would look at that and say, Jesus, I wish they weren't there.
Okay.
I wish there was something else there.
Okay.
But it's not personal. It's not. They're getting, I suppose, what I'm trying to say to you is the people who are in those shops, they're getting the sort of the blame for the way the City Fathers have neglected Moore Street as a historic monument.
Thank
but that's
you
going
very
to change.
Much for your perspective.
Okay, thank you.
And I hope your book is going to be sold. Are you planning to write another book? After
I am. There is a follow-up. By the way, what's the guy in Zimbabwe's name? What's his name? The man you said, like Mr. Jones. What's it?
Chikore. Yes.
So you need to write a story going to work for Mr. Chikore.
Mr. Chikore.
Okay.
Thank you very much for giving us your time, Jen.
No worries, Evan. My pleasure. My absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. This was Culture Shot in Near FM.
The content and views expressed in this program are those of the participants alone and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of Pobl, the Office for the Promotion of Migrant Integration, or the European Commission.